first case of the day is Angus Duffy versus Matria Healthcare, and it's Mr. Withrow.
Yes, Your
Honor. Good morning.
Hey, please support. My name is Bill Withrow, and I represent the appellant Matria Healthcare. The court today asking you to reverse an order entered by the district Magistrate Judge Cole, enjoining us from proceeding with the arbitration of our claims against the appellees, who are former officers and stakeholders of a company that Matria acquired in 2006. In essence, the district court has inverted the policy, the federal policy, favoring arbitration by resolving doubts against arbitration instead of resolving the doubts in favor of it.
Did you just say thwarted or inverted?
Inverted.
Inverted. Okay.
We began with the two provisions that are at issue. The first is Section 7.3D2, which provides, and I'm paraphrasing, that any claim against the parties or their officers and directors which are based directly or indirectly on representations contained in the merger agreement may only be brought as provided in Article 7, which provides for arbitration.
You know, forgive me, but before you start, I'd like to ask you a sort of global type question, and it's this. In the briefs, you seem to argue that Correll and these two individual plaintiffs were one and the same, even though Correll represented all of the stakeholders, and these two individuals, it would seem, owned at most 3% of the stock. It occurs to me that the interests of the 97% would be significantly different from the interests of Duffy and Condren as individuals. So my question is, why should we assume that Correll would adequately represent the interests of Duffy and Condren when the other 97% of the stakeholders would probably be quite happy to have judgment satisfied from the personal assets of those two individuals?
Well, Your Honor, our position on that is that the appellees here did appoint Correll as their representative for purposes of the agreement to arbitrate. These gentlemen, although they were minority shareholders in the company, did receive substantial benefit, and they utilized not just Correll but also Core Solutions as their agent. So in the merger agreement, which Correll was not an explicit party to but did sign and did agree to arbitrate the disputes, it was agreed in the merger agreement that these types of disputes would be arbitrated. Whether Correll could adequately represent the litigation or arbitration of those claims is a question, I think, to be answered between these gentlemen and Correll.
But, I mean, what would be your best argument, do you think, for binding the two, you know, these two non-signatories to the arbitration clause? I mean, you're seeking far more in damages than from them than they earned on this deal. And I, for one, need an explanation of where and how they gave up their right to a jury.
Yes, Your Honor. Well, there are several theories that are recognized in all of the circuit, or most all of the circuits. One is a third-party beneficiary theory. The second is an estoppel theory. And the third is an agency theory. And I think the court's initial question goes to the heart of the agency theory. But let me address the first two. The first is a third-party beneficiary theory. And what this court has said is that third-party beneficiaries of contracts are bound by the arbitration provisions in those contracts. And in this case, in Section 9.10, which is entitled Third-Party Beneficiaries, the agreement states that it is intended to be for the benefit of and shall be enforceable in all respects by the stakeholders. So it is very clear from the agreement itself that these gentlemen are third-party beneficiaries. And additionally, they did benefit through the sale of their shares. As I said, they have netted over in excess of $5 million. They received certain promised benefits, severance benefits, upon their termination from employment, as well as the right to seek indemnity for expenses that they may have incurred in defending their actions as officers and directors. Now, what the stakeholders say in this court is that, you know, conceding that that is an established principle for binding them, they say that nonetheless the claims we assert do not arise out of their third-party beneficiary status. And we believe they clearly do, because we allege in the pleadings, which are in front of the court and a part of the record, that they made false representations and omissions to induce Matria to pay more for the stock that they owned than we should have paid, and that they benefited personally from receiving more for their shares than they would have absent the fraud. So when they acted not just as officers and directors, but also as stakeholders, and under the allegations, sought to receive more for their stock than they should have been entitled to receive as a result of the fraud that we've alleged.
And if they committed the fraud, as you suggest, you're seeking recovery from their personal assets as well as the escrow fund.
That is correct. That is correct, Your Honor.
You know, I'm sort of all over the lot here, but I want to, you don't have too much time to get it in. Why was it necessary to include a provision in the merger agreement consenting to the jurisdiction of the Delaware courts if all of these claims were supposed to go to arbitration? It certainly seems as if the agreement anticipated that some disputes would be litigated rather than arbitrated. Isn't that right?
Well, only one, Your Honor, and that is a claim for specific performance. The 9.7 is an extremely broad clause, and the last sentence says, for the avoidance of doubt, except for claims for specific performance arising after the date hereof and prior to the closing, any claims arising out of this agreement or the breach, termination, or validity thereof shall be finally and, here's an important word, exclusively determined in accordance with the four sections of the merger agreement that require for arbitration. So the parties used in this second sentence extremely expansive language that is very broad and which has been consistently interpreted by this court to require an expansive interpretation. And on top of that, as the federal policy suggests, and this gets back to my original comment, what the Supreme Court has said is that any doubts regarding the scope of the arbitration clause have to be resolved in favor of arbitration. And this court said in the Kiefer Specialty Flooring case in 1999 that a court may not deny a party's request to arbitrate unless it can be said with positive assurance that the arbitration clause is not susceptible of an interpretation that covers the dispute, citing Supreme Court authority. So we believe and we submit that 9.7 in and of itself is extremely expansive, very similar to the kind of broad and all-encompassing clauses that this court has consistently construed to sweep within their scope all matters arising or all disputes arising out of the agreement itself. And this conclusion is especially reinforced when one considers the federal policy favoring arbitration. I think what the appellees have to demonstrate, and they haven't and can't, is that it cannot, that there is no interpretation here that the arbitration clause covers the dispute. At the very worst, from my perspective.
I'm sorry, my hearing isn't great today. Say that just one more time, please.
What they have to show is that the arbitration clause is not susceptible, not even susceptible of an interpretation that it covers the dispute in question. And we think at worst, from our perspective, this clause is ambiguous. At best, it very clearly provides for arbitration of the dispute. Now, what the district court said, Magistrate Judge Cole said, and what the appellees assert on appeal is that the second sentence is just a duplication. It's just surplusage. It is what the district court referred to as obsessiveness or over-lawyering, and merely restated what was in the first sentence of the agreement. But if you adopt that position, then you are violating one of the fundamental tenets of contract construction, which is that all provisions of a contract have to be given meaning. What 9.7 means in the first sentence is that the parties consent to they consent to the jurisdiction of the Delaware courts for any claim which is not required to be arbitrated. And what the second sentence makes clear is that all claims are arbitrable except the claims for specific performance.
Getting back to this recovery, as you said, you want the personal assets as well as the escrow fund. And Article 7 speaks repeatedly about the escrow fund and says that the escrow fund disputes must be arbitrated. Why doesn't the plain language of 7.4 mean that if your claim seeks personal assets, that section doesn't require arbitration?
Because, Your Honor, that position that was taken by the magistrate judge here, as well as by the appellees, ignores the exclusive remedy provision of the contract. And what that clause says, which is in 7.3d4, is that except for claims involving fraud, the right to make a claim on the escrow fund shall be the exclusive remedy of the party. So, yes, Article 7 does speak repeatedly about claims on the fund. It does cap the recovery to the amount of the fund. It does provide, as they say, that the fund does not need to be replenished. But the agreement is also clear in 7.3d4 that when there is a claim for fraud, that those limitations disappear, and that is why we believe that the provisions that they rely upon are not controlled. I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, and I'll defer for further questions in a moment. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll get Mr. Nelson up here.
Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Bradley Nelson. I represent the plaintiffs and appellees in this case, Mr. Angus Duffy and Mr. Michael Condren. I'd like to focus on the two principal issues that I raised in our briefs and that I think have been the court has started to address so far. One is the fact that the Matria's claims in this case simply are not escrow fund disputes that are subject to arbitration under the merger agreement. And the second is that even if the parties to the merger agreement had agreed to arbitrate the kinds of claims that Matria is asserting here, my clients were never parties to that merger agreement. They didn't agree to arbitrate those or any other claims and can't be drawn into the arbitration proceeding.
In Section 7.3D2 of the merger agreement, there is this reference to claims against any of the parties, quote, or any of their respective directors, officers, employees, affiliates, successors, permitted assigns, or representatives. Now, why would this section mention this broad group of persons, unless those persons are somehow bound by this agreement? What meaning do you give to that provision?
Well, that provision, Your Honor, is preceded by the language that the parties intend to shorten the statute of limitations. And that whole section deals with the shortened claims period. And as the district court found, the whole purpose of that section was that Matria was agreeing that any claims it had arising out of this merger of any kind against anyone would be subject to this shortened limitations period. And that's what Section 7.3D2 says. The parties intend to shorten the statute of limitations and agree that after the closing date, any claims or causes of action against anybody may only be brought as expressly provided in this Article 7. We believe that the language of that, if anything, defeats Matria's right to bring a claim against our clients in arbitration, because Article 7, if you look at what claims are expressly provided for in Article 7, the only claims that are expressly provided for in Article 7 are in Section 7.4 is our escrow fund disputes, which are claims against the escrow fund.
And then looking at that same section that Judge Rovner made reference to, you agree then that Matria can bring a fraud claim against your clients in court? Subject to statute of limitations.
Subject to a lot of different things, Your Honor, and including, I think, if you look at the integration clauses of this agreement, it's clear, you know, that we think that Section 9.1, for example, and 9.9 of the agreement make it clear that Matria represented in this agreement that it wasn't relying upon any representations or statements or omissions from anyone other than the selling corporation, Core Solutions, and other than those representations that were explicitly set forth in Article 3 of the merger agreement. So subject to all of that, I agree that the exclusive remedy provision suggests that they can try to state a claim for fraud outside of arbitration and in court, and that they could attempt to do that. We think that there's all kinds of other defenses that would preclude those claims. But just in terms of the proper forum for them, I think that Article 7 provides that they could file those in a court of law.
According to the defendants, all of the stakeholders appointed Corral to be their agents for all purposes under the merger agreement. Why wouldn't that be enough to bind you to the arbitration clauses in the merger agreement?
Well, I think as the district court properly held that Corral was appointed as a stakeholder representative for purposes of the agreement. And the agreement makes it clear that Corral's role is to process claims against the escrow fund. Corral is the escrow agent, it has control of the escrow fund, and receives and defends any claims by Matria against that fund. There's nothing in the agreement that appoints Corral as the representative of individual stakeholders with respect to any claims against them individually. The court in Delaware recognized that when it said that Corral was before the court as the representative of the stakeholders only with respect to the escrow fund and not with respect to claims that might theoretically be filed against the individuals. The Corral has repeatedly taken the position that it doesn't represent individual stakeholders. It refused to pay for any legal fees or assume the defense of any claims against individual stakeholders. And so there's simply there's nothing in the agreement itself, and there's nothing in the way the parties have conducted themselves to suggest that Corral is the representative with respect to those kinds of claims.
Well, Corral represented all of the stakeholders, just not any stakeholder individually. That's your bottom line argument.
They represent the stakeholders collectively,
right,
with respect to their interests in the escrow fund, which is how it's spelled out in this agreement and the accompanying escrow agreement that was signed along with this.
So I can make sure I'm clear on this. If a claimant seeks recovery from both the escrow fund and the officer's personal assets for fraudulent conduct, what procedure would the claimant need to follow? Are you saying the arbitration would be required for the escrow fund amount, but a separate suit would be required to recover personal assets?
Yes.
And even if a claimant seeks recovery from the two sources, why wouldn't just one arbitration be required? Couldn't the agreement be read to require arbitration of the entire claim because recovery is sought out of the escrow fund?
I don't believe so, because Section 7.4, by definition, limits arbitrable claims to what's defined as an escrow fund dispute. And that's a claim by Matria against the escrow fund based on misrepresentations of the or breaches of the representations and warranties in Article 3 of the agreement.
But the arbitration clause in Section 9.7 is not so limited.
Well, Section 9.7 was actually not an arbitration clause, but it's the consent to jurisdiction provision. That's what it's titled. And 9.7, the first sentence of 9.7 says that the parties consent except as provided in sections 2.9, 5.12, 7.4, and 7.5. The parties agree that any claims arising under this agreement shall be prosecuted exclusively in the courts of Delaware. The last sentence then raises this doubt about and then says that for the avoidance of doubt, any claims must be arbitrated pursuant to these four provisions. Matria's construction of that's a broad arbitration clause that requires arbitration of all claims arising under this agreement, simply isn't tenable. If you go through this agreement, I went through over the last couple of days and counted at least 17 different provisions in this agreement that imposed obligations on the parties, the breach of which does not fall within any of these four narrowly tailored arbitration provisions. There are a whole series of representations and warranties in Article 4 of the agreement, representations and warranties of the buyer, Matria. The breach of any of those doesn't fall within any of these arbitration clauses and is not arbitrable. The basic obligations of the agreement, to close the transaction, to pay the closing price, Matria's obligation to fund the escrow fund, the breaches of those don't fall within any of these arbitration clauses. There's all kinds of provisions in this agreement. Article 5 of the agreement is filled with obligations of the parties, the breach of which would not fall within any of these four narrowly tailored arbitration provisions.
Well, what's the import of that concluding language in Section 9.7, then, and the reference to exclusivity?
Yeah, I think it can only mean what the district court found that it means, which is that the parties, you know, they consented to jurisdiction for all claims arising under the agreement other than in these four provisions, the jurisdiction of the Delaware courts for all claims other than those falling within those four arbitration provisions, and then decided, since they did that, they wanted to clarify that anything that falls within those four arbitration provisions has to be arbitrated.
I'm having some difficulty reconciling your position and the district court's position with the Delaware Chancery Court's decision insofar as it treated the fraud claims as arbitrable. And maybe you can elaborate on that a little. In particular, footnote 37 of that decision.
The district court's decision.
The Chancery Court's decision.
I'm sorry.
In Delaware. Reserving the question of whether Matria's fraud claims are limited to the escrow fund as a question for the arbitrator to address, even though the case before the court there was solely against Coral as the representative for escrow fund claims. So it seemed to contemplate, and when read in context with the oral argument in that case, the parties seemed to contemplate that there might be wider litigation before the arbitrator following this decision, or at least that's my reading between the lines.
Well, it happens, I think, in opinions a lot, and that is because the Delaware court had sort of the easy issue before it, and the district court sort of explained this and said that, you know, the Delaware Chancery Court pointed out several times in its decision that it was only deciding the case before it, and that was Matria's claim against the escrow fund. And it said, I think in connection with the discussion that you're speaking of, the court said this is particularly true in that the claims before us are Matria's claims against the escrow fund. And the court was careful to point out that the claims against individual officers and directors were only theoretical and that the court was not deciding those issues.
Well, then what's the point of that footnote?
The point of the footnote? I think in the context of deciding that Matria's claims against the escrow fund are arbitrable, I think, I think standard practice in with a lot of courts and standard basic law on arbitrability is once you decide that certain claims are arbitrable, you send it to the arbitrator, and the arbitrator decides then the scope of what's included in the arbitration. And so I think the Delaware court was simply falling back on that body of case law, which says that if certain claims are arbitrable, then the scope of arbitrability is up to the arbitrators.
Isn't that the same thing as saying these claims are arbitrable?
The claims against the escrow fund?
The claims against your clients?
No, I think that's an entirely different matter. And I think that, the decisions of this court and other courts have pointed out that when you're looking at the issue of whether non-signatories can be forced to arbitrate, that the same thing doesn't apply, and that the opposite standards really apply. It's up to the party seeking arbitration first to establish that there's an agreement to arbitrate between these parties. Once there's an agreement to arbitrate between these parties, then the presumption falls that the scope of what's within the arbitration goes to the arbitrator.
Well, but the third-party beneficiary language in the contract explicitly addresses the binding nature of the merger agreement on your clients, so we can skip over that first line of inquiry and focus on whether the claims are arbitrable.
Well, we don't believe so, Your Honor. We believe, first of all, that Matria has waived the third-party beneficiary argument. It's a estoppel argument, and it's agency argument because it didn't raise those in its opening brief in this court. It raised the estoppel and third-party beneficiary arguments only in a footnote, never developed those arguments, and then tried to assert those arguments in sort of full-blown fashion for the first time in their reply brief. We believe those have been waived. If the court is inclined to address those, we would ask leave to file some supplemental authority on those issues. We haven't really had the chance to address those issues in full. They were addressed in full in the district court. The district court addressed and rejected their third-party beneficiary argument, as well as their agency argument, their estoppel arguments. And we believe that decision is correct.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay. 3 minutes.
I'd like to address a few of the points that were raised by Mr. Nelson. First of all, regarding the scope of 7.3D2, he says it's just a limitations period, and therefore it must mean that the claims are to be litigated. But of course, he draws sole support for that argument based on the heading for the provision, and as the agreement specifically says, the headings are not to be used to interpret the party's intent. Furthermore, and most importantly, Magistrate Cole rejected that position, so the very opinion that they're seeking to have you affirm, that argument was specifically rejected by Magistrate Cole. Mr. Nelson says that Coral was appointed only for purposes of the escrow agreement, and it's true that that is language that appears in 24A of the agreement, but there are many provisions, including those in 24.B, and in point of fact, I've probably been remiss in all the many arguments I've made about this provision and not trumpeting more the provisions in 24B, because what 24B says is that the company, Core Solutions, the company we bought, authorizes parent, that's my client, Matria, and its merger subsidiary to rely on the stakeholder representative having the power and authority, and I'm going to ellipsize this language a little bit, to take such actions on behalf of each stakeholder as the stakeholder representative in its sole judgment may deem to be in the best interest of the stakeholders or otherwise appropriate on all matters related to and arising from this agreement, to include, without limitation, taking or refraining from taking any action whether by negotiation, settlement, litigation, or otherwise, to resolve or settle all matters and disputes arising out of or related to this agreement. And so I submit, Your Honors, that this is extraordinarily broad language granted to Coral to act, and that they are bound by the actions of Coral in agreeing to arbitrate these disputes. 9.7. He says it's, Mr. Nelson says it's merely a consent to jurisdiction clause, relying again on an argument heading that can't be used by the terms of the agreement to interpret the party's intent. He says, I've counted various things in here that aren't tied specifically to one of the four provisions. However, the agreement says, and it's very clear, that any claim arising out of it, of the agreement, has to be decided in accordance with one of the four. It says, it references the four, and it says, or four. It doesn't make it, it doesn't have to be arbitrable if it just happens to fall within the scope, but the use of the word or in that clause, I submit, is very important, because what it says is that if you've got any dispute other than a claim for specific performance arising out of or relating to this agreement, it has to be decided by one of those four mechanisms. And the fact that a particular provision isn't referred earlier in the agreement to an arbitration provision specifically is of no moment. I see my time is up.
I take it that you would concede that the interests of the group as a whole differs from the interests of the individual stakeholders.
I would concede that the interests of the whole would differ from the interests of these two individuals. But again, Your Honor, I'm not saying that, although they granted Coral the authority to conduct litigation on their behalf. That is clear. What I'm saying is that the authority they granted Coral to arbitrate the disputes, which clearly Coral has agreed to do, is binding upon them. If they don't believe that their interests are adequately represented by Coral, they can have their own counsel. In fact, we've named them separately, and they do have their own counsel to represent their individual interests. But that doesn't impact their grant of authority to Coral, which in turn agreed through the merger agreement to arbitrate these disputes.
Okay. We'll take the case under advisement.